The Rhone Ranger mission is to educate the public on Rhone varietals grown in America and to promote the production and enjoyment of these wines. It's hard to say who led the way, but the first plans to produce Rhone-style wines in the US started in the 70s. With that, a group of producers came together forming the original Rhone Rangers. With that, they created a movement that still resonates after 50 years and in many ways inspired many producers to change and develop into different ventures. Later, the Spice du Rhone, a festival that draws winemakers and fans from around the world for tasting and seminar, blossomed in Paso Robles, California. Yet, somewhere along the way, the Rhone movement lost its mojo. Much like Pinot Noir before the movie Sideways, Syrah became an hard sell. In this episode, I spoke with author, journalist Patrick Comsky, who has never lost his passion for the American Rhones. Comsky has penned the definitive work on the Rhone movement. American Rhone, how maverick winemakers changed the way American drinks. The American Rhone movement has stalled and seems to in need of a spark. We talk about the origin of the movement and how hard it was at the beginning and the wider effects of it. Why did Syrah fallen out of fashion? And also we discussed the Petit Syrah. Also we discussed about the Petit Syrah and its interesting origin. Hi, I'm Mattia Scarpazza and this is the Looking Into Wine podcast. Wine and winemaking can be complex, but this podcast has a simple mission. We want to give you the skills and tools to harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, process, and concept that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you enjoy the show and your own journey, Looking Into Wine. Welcome to Looking Into Wine. I'm Mattia Scarpazza, your host, and today with me I have Patrick Comiskey, author of American Rhone. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Mattia.
Patrick, what was the reason you write this book and how did you form this beautiful story?
Well, I started in the restaurant industry in San Francisco, California, when the whole wine movement in California was starting to explode. It was really an exciting time. There were new producers, new possibilities with different varieties and different interests that were happening all over the state. And it really did stem from a kind of culinary explosion that begins in Berkeley, California in the 70s with places like Chez Panisse, and in San Francisco with places like Zuni Cafe. These were some of the most exciting places for food in the country, and they ended up being really interesting repositories for alternative wines as well. The producers that I ended up writing about became part of that story when they would come and be inspired by exciting wines from the Côte du Rhône, exciting wines from Provence, rosés that didn't taste sweet or cloying. It was an exciting time to be a wine drinker because there was so much discovery at hand. And eventually, many of those people just decided, what the hell, I'm going to give it a try. And it became a very exciting kind of individual movement, and eventually it moved into a group movement. But my personal start was as a sommelier. And I worked in a place called 42 Degrees, which was devoted to wines and food of the 42nd parallel, which roughly speaking is Italy, southern France, northern Spain, and that kind of thing. And so my wine list reflected those latitudes and a great many of American producers who were kind of replicating or mimicking those wines from the Southern Rhone, wines from Garnachas and Tempranillos from Spain, and of course Northern Italian wines as well.
So this the group we're talking today is the Rhone Rangers. It was interesting reading the book how difficult it was at the beginning to find Rhone's grape and Rhone's wines. And how did the American producer got to try their wines and how did they find the grapes to plant them?
There are a lot of exciting individual stories to answer your question, but it's important to know that Rhone varieties were on California soil as early as the 1850s. So a good 150 years before the Rhone movement really gets its start, French immigrants, Italian immigrants, Spanish immigrants, Portuguese immigrants were coming into the country, sometimes just to pursue gold, there was the gold rush of 1848 and 9. And they would bring with them their things from their home, which included, of course, grape cuttings. And so there was this kind of crazy willy-nilly patchwork of vines grown all over California. And eventually in the latter part of the 19th century, around the 1880s and 90s, a number of professors in California started to tabulate what was around and what was actually working, and what was producing wines of quality, and what varieties could be eliminated. And a lot of the Rhone varieties, specifically Syrah, Grenache, Mourvedre, Carignan, Sanso, to a lesser extent, the white varieties Marsanne and Roussanne, all of those were evaluated, tasted, looked at. Some were recommended, many more were not. But on the strength of some of those early evaluations, some of these vineyards actually hung around. There are still a handful of Syrah vines planted in the late 1890s in California. There are still a small number of Grenache vines with similar provenance. And there are even older vineyards of Carignan and Sanso in other parts of California. So to come back to your question, what happened after that is that these producers who were starting to taste wines from the southern Rhone and northern Spain and so forth started looking around for the varieties that were inspiring them in these newfangled restaurants, and started to look for them and to their great surprise discovered that there were quite a few plots lying around that were still producing and could still make quality wine. So as a result, there were a number of producers that were making individual lots without really knowing what the other was doing. And eventually, in the early 90s, they started to notice each other. Right around the early 90s and late 80s, they started to talk to each other, compare notes, sell fruit to each other, and also primarily exchange cuttings and start to propagate decent-sized...
What I was reading the book, which is full of details, and didn't quite realize how much control the Cabernet Sauvignon and the Chardonnay was there in the 70s and 80s, and how much work they needed to do to find enough Syrah and cuttings and planting. It was very difficult. And there was a story of someone having to come back with a suitcase full of cutting.
Suitcase clones were pretty common during this period. There simply wasn't enough varietal cuttings for these varieties in normal official circles. And by official circles, I'm talking about the U.S. Department of Agriculture and University of California, Davis. What they had was clonally suspect, at least according to the producers involved. And so they simply started to take their own from France and bring it over and propagate it and plant it. It was very much mixed results. Some of the plant material was virused or diseased. And it wasn't until the middle to late 90s that Tablas Creek primarily decided to formally bring the varieties over to the United States through the USDA and Foundation Plant Services.
Okay, so it was late. It was almost like 20 years on that the first two people planting it, and it was quite a long time. For me, it was interesting to hear about what would you think was the biggest affected in this range Ron made to the consumers. Well, in the this, especially in the 90s when there was the peak time for the...
It was very much an uphill battle in the early going. No one really knew what the Rhone Rangers, what the varieties were. They found the wines to be charming and interesting, but they also were filled with varieties whose names people couldn't pronounce, like Viognier and Mourvèdre, and they didn't really understand what they were supposed to mean. And so what the Rhone Rangers really provided ultimately was a marketing arm to get people excited about the varieties. And there were two big marketing efforts that I document in the book. The first is the Rhone Rangers, and we've been talking a little bit about them, which is kind of a loosely organized group of American producers who worked together and threw tastings together and got in front of wine writers and critics in order to bring their message home. And they had a couple of really colorful and charismatic leaders in that movement, which we can talk about in some more detail. And they were the ones that were really getting the word out, and they were being slightly outrageous in order to get attention, and it really did play a great role. One of the ways in which the Rangers became kind of personified was in a kind of cowboy shtick pastiche, where they would be wearing red 10-gallon hats and red vests, and they always had a little badge on their lapel that said Rhone Ranger. Some of them would walk around with fake six shooters and just sort of pretend that they were out in the frontier being rootin' tootin' Rangers. The other big marketing arm was an annual tasting held in Paso Robles, California, called the Hospice de Rhone. Now, the big difference between the two of them, first of all, they were run by entirely different people, but Hospice de Rhone was not oriented solely to domestic producers. It was intending to bring American producers under the tent of international winemaking. And so all kinds of people were brought in from all over the world to share their wines and to bring attention to the 23 varieties that make up the Rhone Pantheon. In many instances, it was the first opportunity for people to meet with and taste alongside some of the greatest producers of the Rhone Valley, some of the greatest producers of Priorat, some extraordinary, groundbreaking producers in Australia, in the Barossa Valley and McLaren Vale, and so on and so forth. It was really one of the first and greatest opportunities to bring these people together in some exciting ways. And they were, and not only that, they were some of the most fun parties I've ever attended.
I saw some videos. They looked quite interesting. Also, yeah. You say that there were two different groups, but I can imagine there was this sense of bondage between the producers, and a lot of the producers in the book, and they started in the 70s, 80s, they're still around now, and they're still producing wine, and they're very famous. And you were saying earlier a couple of the most out there producer were possibly, it was Randall Graham.
Randall Graham founded Bonnie Doon Winery in the very early 80s. He wanted to make great Burgundy in California soil. It proved to elude him. He couldn't do it. And he was making Pinot Noirs that he found were very, very boring. And he just thought, this is not going to cut it. So he started to look around for other possibilities. And he found an old Grenache vineyard not terribly far from his home vineyard in the Santa Cruz Mountains, or in the Santa Cruz area. And he made a really good wine somewhat effortlessly out of old vine Grenache. And from there, he started to make a very famous blend that he called the Cigar Volant. So when the Rhone Ranger started, he was a natural showman. He became their point person, their spokesman, their clown, their huckster, if you will, and really became the face and voice of the Rhone Rangers, and a lot of people kind of flowed in behind him.
And he's a character, and some
he is that.
And
to this day,
exactly. And you can see there is the famous picture of him with the horse and then front page for I don't remember the publication now.
It was the Wine Spectator. And there's kind of a fun little story about that. He according to Randall, what he told me is that he was told to come to a photo shoot and to bring a horse. And he's like, well, okay, I live in the country. I guess it's not too hard for me to come up with a horse. And so he did. They decided that there was a black diamond on the schnoz of the horse, and they decided to kind of paint that up with whiteout or something like that, and he got dressed up in Lone Ranger clothing, and the rest is history.
Absolutely. As there's a picture, I tried to post it on the show notes. It's very interesting. And so moving to the grape varieties of the Rhone Rangers, because they did a lot of work with bringing all these new grapes. So what were the key grapes for the movement?
Early on, and arguably to this day, Syrah is kind of the tentpole of the entire Rhone pantheon in California, for sure. It's the easiest one to grow. It's grown more widely than in any other variety. It is versatile in terms of making a very good wine in warm climates, and in my opinion, some of California's best wines in cool climates. It really has become ubiquitous. There may or may not be a good thing for Syrah, but it remains one of the most important red variety, followed probably by Grenache. Grenache is a little bit harder for people to get their head around, both in terms of consumers and in winemakers, but it really is well suited to California's climate, and its range is much more limited than Syrah's, but it really does have in warm climates it can really shine. My personal, I'm not going to say favorite, but I think that the one that maybe most naturally that can work with California's climate most naturally is probably Mourvèdre. Mourvèdre makes some of the most thrilling wines that are at once accessible and incredibly diverse and complex at the same time. There's a tremendous amount of old vine material for Mourvèdre that that remains really expressive and really exciting. It's, for me, one of the most happy-making wines in California soils that I know, at least among red wines. And it has attracted a number of really talented winemakers. It also, of course, forms the blend, part of the blend for what is now a ubiquitous category called GSMs, Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, red blends, Côte du Rhône in style, and the Mourvèdre kind of provides a ballast and a kind of a tannic fortitude to wines that would otherwise be kind of lush and silly.
Talking about the blending, I mean, as I was reading, and their style of the Rhone Ranger was very much trying to replicate what the one of the Rhone Valley and try to bring that close to home. But that sort of not changed, but there was another style and then came up from the Australia of Syrah. What sort of style they were going for as a like blending of wine they were looking to mimic?
Well, I think what you're referring to is the kind of the identity crisis that Syrah ended up experiencing in starting around 2000, what happened was multiple styles of Syrah were fairly easy to produce in California vineyards and with California soils. In particular, there were a number of things that sort of came together. The first is the invasion of Australia, so to speak, where Australian wines and Australian Shirazes in particular really started to be a very important market force in the American wine industry. The second is Robert Parker, who privileged wines of big extract and big power, high alcohol. And when you grew wines to make wines of that sort in California, at least with respect to Syrah started to lose its character, or really its distinctiveness when you kind of go for that style in California. There's still plenty of wines made in that style in California, but the number of them has shrunk considerably over the last 10 or 15 years, corresponding with Parker's retirement. And the third thing, though, is that ultimately consumers were uncertain about what it was they were going to get whenever they opened a bottle of Syrah. Were they going to get something big, huge, and lush, or were they going to get something funky and aromatically compelling and even weird? Consumers got quite gun-shy about wanting to even reach for a bottle of Syrah when they didn't know what they were going to get. In the book, I refer to Syrah as the Riesling of red wines, because it prompted in consumers a kind of trepidation about purchasing it at all when they didn't entirely know what it was they were going to find in the bottle.
And you were saying now that the sort of with the shrinking, and there is possibly a bit clearer indication of what style it is because there is less produced, possibly there is more movement towards the classic style of Syrahs.
I think so. Stylistically, in general, American wines are much more adventurous and less slavish to the market. Winemakers are finding that they can take risks and still find consumers who will enjoy them. And natural wine movement has something to do with that. Parker's receding into the sunset is another one. There isn't one voice any longer in the American wine market. There are several advocates work in different directions. Finally, I think some of the winemaking techniques that go into making Syrah and some of these other Rhone varieties, things like whole cluster fermentation, reining in ripeness and alcohol levels, making the wines in order to privilege aromatic complexity. These are all really important trends in the way that Syrah is even approached. And in order to retain that aromatic complexity with Syrah, you really do have to harvest it at a lower Brix level with lower sugar levels. You have to preserve some of these interesting phenolics that make Syrah so weird and wonderful to me.
There was a question, it was big session in the book about, in very much detail, to be honest, of the Petit Syrah case. And I think for me, I'm in Europe, Petit Syrah is not, we don't come across as much as possible a consumer, but I think it's very interesting the difference of what is about within Syrah and Petit Syrah.
Well, the first thing I want to say about Petit Syrah is that if you do find a bottle from a quality producer, put it in your cellar and wait 20 years, because it'll be good when you open it now, but if you wait 20 years, you will find one of the most beautiful and profound claret-like wines that America produces right now. Some of the most extraordinary bottles of California wine that I've tasted in my lifetime are Petit Syrahs from the 70s and early 80s, where the wines go into the bottle with a great deal of heft and extract and brawn, and they come out They're so delicate and so beautiful and so aromatically complex. And they have this beautiful kind of delicacy where that Petite Sirah is not known for. But you have to wait. And that's the issue. Petite Sirah, well, I need to start with Syrah. Syrah came to this country under several names, including Petite Sirah. But it was known as Syrah with an I. Shiraz, of course, eventually became part of the... It was known as Hermitage. It was known as... there was a variety, still a variety, or a variant of Syrah called Serene. It was referred to as Serene. And many, many other people referred to it as Petite Sirah. And they were referring essentially to a clonal variation that was found in the Northern Rhone, in Hermitage and Côte Rôtie in particular. So Syrah is in the United States already with a half a dozen names. And around 1890, this other variety, which was named in France Durif, named after its founder, who had basically isolated a hybrid of Syrah and I can't remember what the other variety was. He isolated it in a vineyard in Montpellier, and he put his own name on it, Durif, and it started to get exported to the United States along with many, many other varieties. And somewhere along those lines, it was mistaken for the true Syrah. And that mistake was carried forward for a good 70 years. Where Petite Syrah and Syrah, both in name, in plantation, and really in bottling, were interchangeable. People would plant Petite Syrah and inevitably Syrah would end up in the same vineyard. People would plant mixed black vineyards of multiple varieties, and it would be a mixture of Petite Syrah, Syrah, Carignan, Sanso, Mourvedre, et cetera, et cetera. Zinfandel. But in the kind of the great mix-up that was the early plantings of the 1900s and until Prohibition, Petite Syrah and Syrah started to get mixed. And then as Syrah kind of went by the wayside, Syrah in the early part of the 20th century generally ripped out and removed, except for tiny pockets, because it was thought to be a poor bearer. It didn't give good yields. Petite Syrah gave great yields, and so people privileged that over the other. And around the mid, they started to realize that the Syrah that they knew from France and the Petite Syrah that was growing in the United States were not the same wine at all. And so then it took another three decades to remove the one from the other. And to recognize that they indeed were different things. And this is something that producers have to recognize, then officials have to recognize, and viticulturists have to recognize, then the government has to step in and find a way to separate the one from the other in terms of its labeling. They became very entangled, and it took probably three decades to disentangle them.
Wow, that's an interesting story. And I think on towards the end of the book, and I think the sad story for Syrah has always been a bit of having problem with the different styles producer, and then consumers got a lot of confusions and things like that. That sort of, as you say in the book, in the 2000s led to decrease of production of Rhone grape varieties and everything. But my question is, what is it to the contemporary Rhone Rangers? What are they doing at the moment?
Yeah, both of the marketing entities, Hospice du Rhone and Rhone Rangers, are still very much up and running. Hospice du Rhone, of course, as an event, has been canceled for the last couple of years because of COVID. Before that, they actually decided to stop, and then were kind of urged out of retirement, and now they are they're still planning an event in 2021 this year. If the pandemic doesn't keep it from happening, the Rhone Rangers. Well, let me put it this way. The Rhone Rangers issued, kind of gave everybody the permission to like something other than Cabernet and Chardonnay and Merlot. Some of the more doctrinaire varieties that could be found in California production. And the Rhone Rangers and Rhone varieties more generally taught people that there were all kinds of different wines out there for them to try, and they were given permission to seek out alternatives. The Rhone Rangers really became the first entity to celebrate alternative winemaking and wines in the United States. Now, of course, that has exploded. So in terms of the influence of Rhone Rangers, can't be overestimated for opening the floodgates for varietal expression in California and in the United States. Having said that, you know, now the world is so big and so diverse that the Rhone Rangers occupy a relatively small portion of both market share and of attention. But they're still plugging along. They have a really strong chapter in Paso Robles where Rhone varieties are king. And they still have a number of icons that are part of the world of the Rhone Rangers, including Randall Graham, another winemaker that is a pioneer that we haven't talked about, named Steve Edmonds, is still very involved, even though he's getting up in years. He's still making really beautiful Rhone wines, as well as other varieties, Spanish varieties, actually. And they still conduct seminars. They still work as a marketing network. They do little road tours to different cities. And I know that it's probably been a decade or so, but they've been to London. They've had London entourages, and they have a small but fervent international effort as well. So they're very much alive. They're just drowned out a little bit by the great variety of options that we have as American wine consumers.
Absolutely. I mean, I expected there would be some new producer also coming up, and so.
And yes, and also there are new producers all the time. There have been a small number of winemakers who have been producing wines of exceedingly low alcohols, like 11% and 12% alcohols, with Syrah in particular, that have achieved a great deal of market success. It really has amounted to an alternative to some of the big bombastic, crazily powerful wines that kind of established the movement. Because you're on two poles. The only American Syrah to have been number one on the Wine Spectator's top 100 was a Paso Robles Syrah from Saxum, from James Berry Vineyard, if I'm not mistaken. This had never happened before. It did about 8 years ago. And so there's still very much a market for those wines. And one of the great cult wines of California remains Sinequinon, which is a Rhone-oriented producer, based out of Ventura, but making wines from the Santa Rita Hills and the Southern Central Coast. So there is still a market for, you know, for big, robust, big-shouldered red wines from Rhone varieties. But there's also this new enclave that's creeping into view of really pretty, relatively delicate, aromatically wild red wines that really are all about refreshment and lift as opposed to power and brawn.
I can see that happening in the UK as well. There's a big, possibly thanks to the national movement, and also in London, there's this search for this freshness and lightness, and I'm sure Rhone varieties, they can do that since so Grenache, they can make this very fresh and pretty wines, and yeah, they can age as well. I mean, Patrick, as I say, the book is full of details, and there's a lot of interesting stories from the early 60s, and it's put the story through the microscope and really dissected every single aspect of it, and it was a joy to read it. And thank you for this time, this half an hour together, and helping me understanding some new things. So thank you. So the book is American Rhone, How Maverick Winemakers Changed Their Way into American Drinks.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
That was Patrick Komsky, author of American Rhone, How Maverick Winemakers Changed the Way American Drinks. If you enjoyed the episode, remember to hit the subscribe button and to tell your friends about the podcast. Also, be sure to go to mattiascarpazza.com and to subscribe to the mailing list. It's the only way you can listen to the Presage, the after-interview conversation with the guest. You can find Looking Into Wine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and every listening app. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can donate on mattiascarpazza.com. The next episode will be with the legendary Californian producer, Randall Graham. Music produced by Samuele Di Nardo, editing and mastering by Tommaso Ascoli.